Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What's going on, guys? Axel Beats here again for Anime Uproar, and recently we covered all of the abilities of the Straw Hat crew. And since the video seemed to be one that you guys really enjoyed, we wanted to continue our dive into the crew by talking about all of their backstories all in one comprehensive video. As always, if you enjoy these dives into the world of One Piece, be sure to leave a like and comment letting us know what to talk about next time. You can also subscribe to the channel for more content in the future, as subscribing is the best way to stay up to date on all of our videos, and it's a totally free way to support us. But with all the YouTube stuff out of the way, let's get into the video, spoilers and all. So as always, let's start things off with the captain of the crew, Monkey D. Luffy. He is the son of the most wanted man in the world, the revolutionary Monkey D. Dragon, and the grandson of the hero of the Marines, Monkey D. Garp. That said, we know very little about his mother, but if you are interested in a look at some of the most popular fan theories, we actually did a video discussing that pretty recently. A link to that will be in the description down below. Luffy didn't grow up knowing Dragon. Instead, he was being raised by his grandfather. And Garp was definitely a bit of a rough guardian, famously both leaving Luffy to survive on his own in the wild and throwing him down a ravine. All to toughen him up in preparation of becoming a strong marine, though. Things kind of went astray on Garp's plan when Luffy met Shanks and the Red Hair Pirates. They were staying in Fusha Village for an entire year, and Luffy became completely enamored with them, deciding that he wanted to become a pirate and join Shanks' crew. However, Shanks kind of laughed off Luffy joining the crew because he couldn't swim and he was too young, despite the fact that Shanks himself was on Roger's crew at the same age, and there are just plenty of pirates who can't swim because of devil fruits. Of course, prior to the year in Fusha, Shanks actually stole the Gomu Gomu no Mi, or as we later found out, the Hito Hito no Mi mythical model Nika from the world government. This ultimately being what led to it ending up in Fusha Village, where Luffy ate it. Soon after eating the fruit and becoming a rubber man, a mountain bandit named Higuma would kidnap him and try to throw him into the ocean. However, a sea king would attack, eating Higuma in the process and leaving Shanks to swoop in at the last moment to save Luffy, but losing his arm in the process. Luffy would go on to promise to become King of the Pirates, mimicking the words of Gold D. Roger unknowingly, and inspiring Shanks to give him his Straw Hat, having Luffy promise to give it back one day when he became a great pirate. From here, Garp would return to Fusha and take Luffy into the mountains to be raised by the mountain bandit Dadon. Here, Luffy meets Ace and works his butt off to win him over, with Sabo soon to follow. They'd be at odds for quite some time, however one day a member of the Blue Jam Pirates would abduct Luffy, beat him down for hours, and try to get information on where the boys were hiding their treasure. Despite this, Luffy was an absolute Chad lad, held strong, and refused to sell out his friends, showing both his loyalty and how much he cared about Ace and Sabo. From the moment that the boys rescued Luffy from the pirates, Luffy was officially accepted into their group, sparring together, hunting together, and eventually sharing sake and becoming brothers. Things wouldn't exactly stay all sunshine and rainbows for long, though, as Sabo would be brought back to his parents' home and Gray Terminal would be set on fire, with both Luffy and Ace tied down by Blue Jam within it. As all this went down, Sabo would cross paths with Dragon and tell him that the nobles were behind the fire, while Luffy and Ace would manage to escape their ropes, only to be found by Blue Jam and his men. The two of them are barely able to hold their own, but at the last moment, Best Mom Dadon shows up to help Ace fend off the pirates as the rest of the mountain bandits grab Luffy and run. After the fire, Sabo would set sail as a world noble was arriving. However, the Celestial Dragon felt insulted that another ship was in their path and ordered Sabo's ship to be shot down. Of course, we all know that Sabo survived and that he was rescued by the revolutionaries, but at the time, Luffy and Ace believed he was dead, and it devastated them. This, though, acted as a catalyst for each of the brothers. helping them to realize that they weren't ready to become pirates yet, and that they were going to need to become stronger if they were serious about heading out to sea. But most importantly, it gave Luffy a drive to become strong enough to protect his friends, and filled him with a wish to never lose another person again. Luffy and Ace would begin training together more seriously, fighting off the giant beasts of the mountain, or bandits, or sparring, and even dealing with Garp when he visited. And over the next 7 years, they would prepare until Ace set out to sea. Then finally, 3 years after that, Luffy would set out on his own, famously knocking down the King of the Coast that took Shanks' arm on his way out. Moving on to Zoro, he was born in the East Blue, but explained that he left some kind of old life behind once he decided to become an invincible swordsman. He trained in Shimotsuki Village under Koshiro, and even as a child, he was much better than most of the adults around him. However, he was never able to beat Koshiro's daughter, Kuina. While training here, Zoro also crossed paths with Kuina's grandfather, and the creator of the Wado Ichimonji and Enma, Shimotsuki Kozoburo. Kozoburo taught Zoro the magical word Tsunachi that summons all the strength in his heart, despite Zoro never really wanting to use it because it sounds kind of weird. One day when Zoro was training on his own, Kozoburo asked him if the dojo was boring to him. But when Zoro explained that he was doing extra practice because he kept losing to Kuina, Kozoburo decided to gift him a pair of real swords. Also explaining to Zoro that every sword has its own personality that needs to be bent to its master's will. Going on to say that even cursed swords are just a sign of great quality because their powerful will scares off the weak. And this is something that Zoro carries with him throughout the entire series. Most notably early on, we see him taking Kitetsu, despite it being a cursed sword, and always just respecting and even talking to his swords throughout the series. Back to young Zoro though, he would go on to lose to Kuina 2,000 times, then deciding to challenge her to a private match with real swords to finish things once and for all. That said, swapping to real swords really just didn't make a difference, as Kuina still absolutely bodied him. And like, it wasn't even close. The next person to embarrass him that badly would probably be Mihawk, if we're being honest. But while he didn't win the fight, it did lead him to having this heart-to-heart with Kuina. He cried and told her that he dreamed to become the world's greatest swordsman, and she told him that she had the same dream, but that her father told her that women couldn't become swordsmasters, because eventually, a man's body would just become more developed than her own, and the gap that she held over others would diminish quickly. Which, like, kinda a dick move on a dad's part, and when we look at some of the best swordsmen in the series, they don't tend to be the burliest of men. Like, yeah, Zoro's kinda buff, but like, look at Mihawk and pre-time skip Shanks. The dudes are strong, but they're not exactly beefcakes. It's pretty clear that in the world of One Piece, swordsmanship is more about technique than it is about power, so Koshiro kinda just sucks on that one, but you know, no one's perfect. Anyways, Zoro kinda blows up on her, frustrated on her just willing to give up like that, despite dominating over him for so long. To him, it meant that no victory over her could ever be justified. Because regardless of if he beat her the next day or the next year, the idea that she was at a disadvantage because she was a woman would always be there to taint his win. He wanted to win because he was more skilled, not because she was a girl. So here they would make a promise that, odds or conditions be damned, one of them would become the world's greatest swordsman no matter what. And you know what? No, one of them would become the world's greatest swordsperson. Take that, Koshiro. However, things did not go as planned, because in what might be Oda's worst writing choice ever, Kuina, and I cannot stress this enough, fell down the stairs and died the next day, off-screen. What a wild choice. Of course, there's always the Tashigi is actually Kuina theory and all that, but until we have a real, tangible payoff to that, I think this is easily one of the biggest black marks on the series to me. Sure, people have accidents all the time, but I don't think major impactful characters like Kuina should just be falling down the stairs to their death, again off screen, but you'll have to let me know if you agree down in the comments. Either way, Zoro is filled with anger, disappointment, and grief, and he approaches Koshiro to ask him for Kuina's sword, the Wado Ichimonji, saying that he will use it to fulfill their promise and become a swordsman so great that his name will reach her in the heavens. Eventually, Zoro would become aware of Dracul Mihawk, the current greatest swordsman in the world, and set off to sea so that he could challenge him. Being Zoro, though, he would get lost along the way and never find his way back home, needing to rely instead on bounty hunting to survive and earning the title of Pirate Hunter. He also meets Johnny and Yosuke along the way, and he would even be approached by Baroque Works to, Baroque work for them, but he turned that down unless he could become the leader of the organization, going on to kill Mr. Seven, the agent who tried to hire him in self-defense. Finally, Zoro would end up in Shell's Town, where he killed Helmeppo's pet wolf who was attacking a girl named Rika. Zoro agreed to be tied down for a month as punishment, which just about brings us to where Luffy finds him. On to Usopp, the third official member to join the crew, and probably the one with the most simple backstory. He was the son of Yasop, a marksman on Shanks' crew, and he and his mother were left behind as his father went to become a pirate. However, rather than becoming resentful or upset that his dad left them to get pirate milk and never returned, Usopp would rationalize that being a pirate must be something so amazing that it was worth leaving his family behind, which is both wholesome and pathetically sad. Usopp, from a very young age, picked up the habit of telling lies. Most frequently, he would run around the streets yelling that pirates were coming. This would lead to the villagers chasing him or throwing things at him until he left the village. That said, the reason that he was doing this was that his mother was severely ill, and he thought that yelling that pirates were coming, that Yasop was coming, would keep her spirits up as she fought the disease. Hope only goes so far though, and his mother would eventually pass away from that disease, leaving Usopp totally alone. And as you might expect from someone his age in that situation, he kept yelling about pirates throughout the village to keep the attention of others. And while on the surface they were all very annoyed by it, we see later when Usopp leaves that the entire village is waiting for him and disappointed when he doesn't show up. It became something that was part of their daily routines, and it brought a lot of energy and life to the town. That said, of course, the Usopp pirates that he trained would eventually go on to take over for him. Of course, though, the most important person in the town after his mother passed away for Usopp was Kaya, a rich but sick girl who Usopp would tell stories to in order to cheer her up, in the exact same way that he did for his mother. Member number 4, Sanji Vinsmoke, was born in the North Blue to a royal family of the German kingdom. His father, Judge, had genetically enhanced Sanji and his brothers before their birth to remove their emotions and give them superhuman abilities, thus making them the perfect soldiers. That said, Sanji's mother, Sora, was against genetically modifying babies for some reason and decided to take a drug to counteract Judge's efforts. This didn't go as planned, as only Sanji would be born normal, and the effects of the drug severely weakened her own body. Sora is also where Sanji fell in love with cooking. One day he decided to cook for his mother to help her recover, and despite falling on the way to the hospital and completely ruining the dish, she ate the entire thing, smiled, and said it was delicious. And you know what? We need more Sora love in the community. Judge, on the other hand, planned for his 4 boys to lead the German military and began training them very young. But with Sanji's more or less human body, he fell behind and became the target of his brother's bullying, something Judge just didn't care to stop. The only one really being kind to Sanji at any point in his childhood other than his mother was his sister Reiju, who would sometimes tend to his wounds. At the same time, while Sora was promoting Sanji's love of cooking, Judge was all but forbidding it. He eventually realized that Sanji was unlike his brothers and would never become a superhuman, and decided to hold a false funeral for him, then choosing to keep Sanji hidden away in the dungeon with an iron mask over his face. It was also in this dungeon where Sanji first read about the All Blue, which would become his future dream in life. Sanji would spend 6 months in that dungeon, but once the Jirma Kingdom crossed the Red Line and entered the East Blue, Reiju helped him to escape the cell so that he could be free and become a chef. During his escape, he ran into his father, and it was decided that Sanji would be free to go as long as he never told anyone that they were related. So, Sanji renounces his title as prince, and when the Jirma began attacking the Isle of Corsia, Sanji made his way onto the cruise liner called the Orbit, where he began to learn more about cooking. He would stay there for the next 2 years until the Orbit was attacked by Red Leg Zeff, only for Sanji to declare that he can't die here because he needed to find the All Blue. As the Red Leg Pirates were attacking this ship, though, a massive storm broke out, and Sanji ends up falling off the ship into the ocean, leading Zeff to dive in after him and save him. Both the Red Leg ship and the orbit would be torn apart in the storm, and Zeff and Sanji would wash ashore on a large rock in the middle of the ocean, way too high up for them to go down for food, or to make it back up if they ever tried. To make matters worse, the island was completely barren, with only some puddles of rainwater to keep them hydrated, and just two bags of food to keep them alive. Sanji was given the smaller bag as he was a child, and he was ordered to sit on the other side of the island to keep an eye out for ships. He thought that he would have about 5 days worth of food, and he could ration it out to probably make it last about 20. On the fifth day, a ship passed, but he was unable to get their attention. By day 25, he was officially out of food, and begins thinking back on all the food he had wasted in his life. By day 50, he was skin and bones, and by day 70, he decided to check on Zeff, willing to kill the old man and take what food he had left if he needed to in order to survive. But then Sanji cuts into Zeff's bag, and there wasn't a speck of food inside of it. Rather, it had been full of treasure, and Zeff had gone without food the entire time. In fact, in order to give Sanji as much food as possible, Zeff instead decided to eat his own leg, even though it meant he would never be a pirate again. A way more badass version of the story than in the anime. When asked why he would do that, Zeff simply said that it was because they had the same dream, that being to find the All Blue. The old man begins talking about how he's been stranded at sea many times, and each time, he wonders how many men would die at sea, cursing its vastness for being left without food. He talks about how nice it would be to find a restaurant in the middle of the sea, and Sanji promises that when they get out of here alive, he'll help Zeff open the restaurant. And it would be another 15 days, totaling at 85, before the two were saved. And as they promised, soon after they opened the Bratier, the restaurant at sea where the cooks fight, and Sanji would stay there for nearly a decade with the old man, learning to become one of the best chefs in the world, and being taught the blackleg style of fighting along the way. And here he would remain until Luffy eventually came and asked him to join his crew. The final East Blue member, Nami, was born in the Oikot Kingdom, a place completely torn apart by war, with almost no survivors. She was only a baby when Nojiko would pick her up, and together they would eventually be found by a female marine, who was barely holding on to life for herself.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This being Bellemere. Bellemere managed to bring her new adopted daughters back to Kobayashi Village, where she insisted the doctor save them before looking at her. Luckily, all three of them would survive and become a family. And while they were happy for the most part, they were also very poor, and it definitely put stress on them. Bellemere would often skip meals or refashion Nojiko's clothes for Nami to make ends meet. Because of this, Nami picked up the bad habit of stealing, and this was typically for things like books, so that she could learn more about navigation and creating sea charts. The village leader Genzo would often bring Nami back to Bellemere, and Bellemere would just flirt with him to make him flustered and get Nami off the hook. Something we kind of see Nami picking up when she's older, as she definitely uses her sexuality to her advantage, much more than any other member on the crew. One day, Nami would angrily yell at Bellemere for the way they were living. She hated that Bellemere skipped meals, she hated wearing hand-me-downs, and she hated that Bellemere had to put up a front that everything was okay, even going so far as to say that they weren't real family because they weren't connected by blood, and that she wished that she had been adopted by a rich family. Obviously, that isn't really the case, and it was just a child lashing out because she felt guilty that she was making Bellemere's life difficult, and believing that Bellemere would be happier without her around. Nami ran to Genzo's home, and he told her all about how Bellemere had found her in Nojiko and how they brought meaning to her life, and because of that, Nami didn't have to worry about making Bellemere unhappy. But just as Nami was about to head home and apologize and make up with Bellemere, the Arlong pirates attacked, claiming all of Kokoyashi Village as their territory and declaring that Arlong was the ruler of this region. They set in place a monthly tax where every adult would need to pay 100,000 berries and every child would have to pay 50,000. At first, it seemed like Bellemere would be missed because her home was outside of the town, but at the last moment, someone noticed the smoke leaving her home, and the fishmen marched over to check it out. And like I said, Bellemere was already struggling. At the best, she had 100,000 saved away for herself, but there was no way that she could cover all three of them. As Arlong enters her house, Bellemere drops him to the ground immediately as she sticks a gun into his mouth like an absolute Chad lass. But Arlong just bites through it, and by the time Nami and Nojiko make it home, Bellemere is having her arm crushed by Arlong's foot. Genzo speaks up saying that the issue can easily be resolved with money, and that the extra plates at Bellemere's table were because he was supposed to visit, not because she has children. Backing this up is that the village registry says that Bellemere never married or had kids, so everything is set up to allow her to live. The village doctor tells Nojiko and Nami that if they can manage to escape, Bellemere can live because there's no record of them being here. And while the girls agree, Nami begins to understand the difference between the haves and the have-nots, saying that they need to leave or die just because they don't have money. This obviously spurring the importance of money in her eyes in the future. So Bellemere manages to get herself back on her feet and says, "Thank goodness. With the 100,000 berries I saved, I'll be able to save my two children. This money is my children's share, and I don't have enough for myself." Telling Genzo that she can't bring herself to say that she doesn't have a family, even if it meant losing her life. The girls run up, and they all hug and apologize to each other, and Bellemere tells Arlong to leave them be, which he agrees to do if she dies quietly. He holds a gun up to her head, and without flinching, she says her daughter's name, tells them that she loves them, and Arlong pulls the trigger. Honestly, this is one of the best moments in terms of sound design in the entire anime, and every single time I get there, it just hits me like a ton of bricks. Even so, there is no time to mourn, as Hachi finds Nami's sea charts, and Arlong decides to take her prisoner. Genzo tries to stop them, but Kurobe immediately cuts him down, which was always going to happen. Not exactly the smartest move on Genzo's part, but Nami calls out saying that it's okay. No one has to try to save her, just so long as more people don't have to die. Arlong has the villagers beaten down, sinks all of the ships in their ports, and leaves them all in the palm of his flipper. Days later, when everyone is finally able to get up again, they rally a small force and decide to fight the fishmen head on. But Nami shows back up and says that she joined the Arlong pirates as a cartographer. She had even been branded by their tattoo and given wads of cash, thinking that if she has money and if she goes along with what Arlong has to say, then she'll never have to lose anyone. Genzo becomes enraged that she would betray the memory of Bellemere and exiles Nami from the town, and Nojiko chases after her to find her at Bellemere's grave. Nami recounts that Bellemere told them to live on, and as long as they can survive, they will eventually come across good times again. Conversely, even the government wasn't going to help them, because Arlong sunk so many of their ships already. So instead, Nami decided that she would save the village by herself and buy it back for 100 million berries. She thinks that if she has to ask for help from the villagers, then they're probably going to get hurt again, declaring that she's never going to cry and that she'll fight him alone. For the next 8 years, Nami would work for Arlong drawing charts, and in her spare time, she would sneak off to invade other pirates' crews and rob them blind until she had enough money to buy back Kokoyashi Village. Of course, along this journey, she would run into Luffy in Orangetown as she was trying to steal Buggy's treasure map, and that would lead to him saving their town. On to the Grand Line and Drum Island, where Anthony Helicopter joins the crew. Chopper was a red-nosed reindeer who was bullied by all the other reindeers and was never allowed to join into their reindeer games. But one day, Santa came to... I think this is the wrong book. One sec. Ah, yes, here it is. Chopper was a blue-nosed reindeer who was also bullied by all the other reindeer, and this is starting to feel like the same guy. Either way, Chopper was already considered an outcast when he found the Hito Hito Nomi, but once he ate it, he was essentially exiled. By gaining the intelligence of a human, Chopper also gained self-awareness and realized that the other reindeer treated him differently, and he decided to leave them and find a place where he belonged. Next, he tried to live with the humans, turning into his human form and approaching them. However, this human form looked more like an ape man or a yeti, and the humans thought he was a monster and began shooting at him. But there was one man, Dr. Hiraluk, who instead took him in and even allowed him to become his assistant. While Hiraluk would teach Chopper the basics of medicine, he wasn't exactly the most medically savvy doctor himself. He was kind of a quack, so yes, Chopper might have learned some things from him, but the real things he would take away from Hiraluk were his philosophy on life and his dreams. Like I said, Hiraluk wasn't a good doctor, but he was a good person. He taught Chopper to believe that all diseases could be cured, that the Jolly Roger was a symbol of hope, and that you should always do everything you can to help others, even if it puts your own life at risk. Hiraluk himself was also sick, and when his condition worsened, he kicked Chopper out of his house so that he wouldn't have to watch his mentor die. But once Chopper learned what was actually happening, he promised to find a cure and set out for the Amiudake mushroom. This was marked in one of the medical books that Chopper read with a skull and crossbones, the same symbol of hope that Hiraluk had taught him that pirates raise. Chopper would risk his life to find the Amiudake, even crossing his old herd who tried to kill him. By the time he got the mushroom and made it back to Hiraluk's house, he was beaten to near death, covered in cuts and bruises, with a cracked antler and a broken leg. Hiraluk managed to treat Chopper's injuries and even reattached his antlers with a brace, but he was still filled with grief about having let his adopted son get so hurt on his own behalf. As such, Hiraluk would decide to take the Amiudake medicine that Chopper had supplied for him, even knowing that it was actually a fatal poison. Dr. Kureha would be the one to explain to Chopper what he had actually done, and tells Chopper that being kind isn't enough to save people. You actually need medical skills and training, or you're only going to harm them. However, Hiraluk would not let Chopper be the cause of his death. King Wapol had put out a notice that all the country's doctors had fallen ill in an attempt to lure Kureha and Hiraluk out, and while Kureha was too smart and calculated to act on that, Hiraluk couldn't stop himself from trying to save anyone in danger, even if it was likely a trap. He knew that it was a 1 in a million chance that all the doctors were sick, but the country needed those doctors if anything happened, and he was willing to risk his life on the off chance that he could possibly save them. So Hiraluk makes his way up to Drum Castle, where Wapol reveals that it was indeed a trap, and Hiraluk just smiles, saying, "Thank God no one is actually sick. Here I was thinking that the country was in crisis, but it was all a little trick." He gives his whole speech about how a man dies not when he eats a poisonous mushroom, not when he gets an incurable disease or when he is shot, but when he is forgotten. Then turning to Dalton and telling him that a monster will soon arrive, and that that monster is his son, asking them not to hurt him. But with that, Hiraluk raises his cup of sake into the air, exclaims that he had a wonderful life, and thanks Chopper before blowing himself up to ensure that Chopper isn't the cause of his death. Chopper arrives soon after in a blind rage, but Dalton manages to stop him and tells him to leave and not die for this diseased country, convincing him to survive rather than sacrifice himself. Chopper then heads to Kureha's house and begs to be taught medicine, saying that he will become the panacea himself, a doctor who can cure anything. For the next 6 years, Chopper would study under Kureha to learn medicine until the Straw Hats arrived on Drum Island and asked him to join their crew. On to number 6 and my personal favorite Straw Hat, Nico Robin. Robin was born on the island of Ohara and when she was 2 years old, her mother, Nico Olivia, left her with her brother as she journeyed to sea to find the true history of the world and study the poneglyphs. Robin herself would also pick up an interest in archaeology, even beginning to read books within the Tree of Knowledge at a very young age with Clover's permission. Robin's new caretakers, though, were not as welcoming as Clover was. Roji, Olivia's brother, would yell at or beat Robin, telling her that she was unwanted and that she was to stay out of sight, even denying her the ability to join family celebrations. While he might not have liked Robin for plenty of reasons, the most likely one was that her devil fruit often scared other people, with the parents of other children even saying that she was a demon that needed to be avoided. The only real place that Robin ever felt she belonged at was the Tree of Knowledge. As such, she would spend all of her available time there studying, even passing the archaeology exam at only 8 years old and becoming an official scholar. But when she said that she wanted to learn about the true history of the world just like her mother had, Clover said she would be banned from the library if she kept spying on them, as there was no way that she could have known about the true history otherwise. Robin left the Tree of Knowledge crying and ran to the beach where she met Jaguar D. Saul, who had just washed ashore. They became quick friends over the next few days as he worked on building his raft, but things changed when he found out where he was. After learning that he was on Ohara and that he had been speaking with the daughter of Nico Olivia, he warns her that there are battleships on their way to destroy the island because of their research. Meanwhile, Nico Olivia herself had managed to escape from a marine ship with the help of Saul and made it back to Ohara. She warns the people at the Tree of Knowledge that the marines were aware of what they were doing and that they were en route to kill them. But the scholars decided that they would try to stay and protect the Tree of Knowledge and all of the wisdom that they had worked to accumulate over the years. Olivia quickly leaves when she hears that CP9 had showed up, and Robin returns to the tree to ask where her mother is. But Olivia wanted to cut ties with Robin because she was a criminal and didn't want her daughter branded with their association. Olivia had told Clover to keep them separate, so he denies to Robin that Olivia was even on the island. But they don't get much time to talk about this as CP9 arrives and begins to search the tree. Outside, the people of Ohara are being forced onto evacuation boats as Nico Olivia is being detained by CP9 and Spawn Dean. They are soon joined by the rest of the archaeologists who are brought out of the tree, and Clover tells Robin to escape, but she refuses and Olivia finally sees her daughter. When the marines find the poneglyph hidden under the tree, Clover asks to speak to the Gorosei through Spawn Dean's transponder snail. He starts to ask them questions about the Void Century, but before he's able to say the name of the ancient kingdom, the Gorosei orders him to be killed. The buster call is triggered, and Robin calls out to Olivia to ask if she is her mother. Then, just as Bellamir had showed her love for her daughter by saying they were family, Olivia tries to protect Robin by denying they were family. Robin pushes again, saying, "I'm Robin. I've grown, but don't you remember me? Someday I want to be able to hold your hand and walk with you. I've studied hard and became an archaeologist, and I can read the poneglyphs too." A sentence which sealed her fate as a target of the world government. As shells start dropping from the buster call, Spawn Dean and his men turn tail and run, and Robin is given a moment with her mother. They don't get too much time though, as Saul shows up and Olivia asks him to take Robin off the island. Robin, of course, wants to stay with her mother, but Olivia tells her that she is a scholar, and she must know that history is an asset to humanity, and charges her daughter with the duty of passing that history on. Even if Ohara perishes, they shouldn't give up on the future that she'll be living in, with her final words to Robin asking her to live her life to the fullest for her. As Saul carries Robin away, he tells her to be proud of her honorable mother and honorable island that fought so hard against the world, and also tells Robin to pass on the history of this island. Saul continues to protect her all the way to the escape ship, but the other passengers refuse to let the monster girl who is the daughter of a criminal on board, as it would put them in danger as well. She keeps running with Saul, but eventually Aokiji shows up. He and Saul discuss the idea of justice and how it's malleable and changes depending on where you stand, and Aokiji even says that he doesn't like what's happening, but it's for the good of the future. But then, the passenger ship full of innocents was absolutely obliterated by a young Akainu who says that if they're going to wipe out a nation, they should do it thoroughly. Aokiji is disgusted by Akainu's actions, but still needs to fulfill his duties. He begins to freeze Saul solid, as the giant tells Robin to run and that the sea is a vast place, and as long as she lives, someday she will be able to find true friends who will protect her, and that no one is born into the world to be alone. Finally, he reminds her that in times of hardship, all she has to do is laugh and keep smiling, and that if she can do that, she will eventually find her friends. Aokiji comes to the conclusion that absolute justice drives a man insane, so he decides to let the seed that Saul protected grow and see what becomes of it. He prepares a path of ice that will keep her safe until the next island, but before she leaves, he reminds her that he is not her friend, and should she cause any trouble, he will be the first one to come find her. And with that, Robin gets in the boat to row away from her destroyed home, as she quietly cries and tries to keep laughing like Saul wanted her to do. The government would go on to put a 79 million berry bounty on her, calling her the Devil of Ohara. And over the next 20 years, Robin would go on to live in several homes in several cities on several islands. But no matter where she went, every time the story was the same. Those who took her in would feel like she was putting them in danger, and eventually they would either try to turn her into the government for the money, or for their own safety. So instead, she turned to pirates and thugs, hoping that the enemies of her enemy would be her friend. But even so, when they were in danger of being caught, the pirates would try to turn her in or blame her for them being targeted. She was told that her existence was a sin, that it was a plague, and that it was evil. But she carried on, kept running, and searched for the poneglyphs as she went. All until, at 24, she found herself at Baroque Works, and Crocodile took an immediate interest in her as someone who could read the poneglyphs. His plan was to use her to find Pluton and conquer the world, but 4 years later she would of course cross paths with the Straw Hats, and eventually join their crew. Crewmate number 7 is Cuddy Flam, or as he is known now, Frankie. Frankie was born in the South Blue, but he found his way to the Grand Line aboard his parents' pirate ship. That said, they weren't exactly the kindest parents, and literally threw him off the ship into the ocean. He was luckily saved by the legendary shipwright Tom, who took him in as his apprentice after seeing him make cannons out of scrap. Frankie had a bit of a rivalry with Tom's other apprentice, Iceberg, who's actually the one who gave him the nickname Frankie because Cuddy Flam sounded strange. Both Frankie and Iceberg would learn shipbuilding under Tom, and while Iceberg focused more on traditional ships, Frankie tended to build warships called Battle Frankies, meant for hunting sea kings. While Frankie was working with Tom, they were visited by the Roger Pirates on their final voyage, and Odin even invited Frankie to join their crew. However, because of what had happened with his parents, Frankie wasn't the biggest fan of pirates and disliked the idea of becoming one himself. When Frankie was 12, Tom was put on trial for helping the former king of the pirates, Gol Roger, by creating the ship the Oro Jackson. This would have likely resulted in his death, but Tom made a deal for his freedom, offering to build a sea train over the next 10 years, which would allow easy travel between Water 7 and Enies Lobby. And Tom would of course not only go on to create those tracks, but also 3 other lines for the sea train to travel with as well, which had an effect of social good more than enough to make up for building the Oro Jackson. The Marines were just about to let him off free, but Spondum, who was charged with finding the blueprints of Pluton, used the Battle Frankies to attack the area in an attempt to frame Tom, or more specifically, Frankie. Tom would take responsibility for this as he didn't want Frankie to get in trouble, and was sentenced to death as a result. Frankie becomes filled with guilt and regret for having built weapons that hurt people, and more importantly, that had put Tom's life in danger. Spondum accuses Frankie of making these weapons, and Frankie begins to denounce making them, but Tom quickly punches him in the face, saying, "Not my ships, that's the one thing you just can't say. No matter what the ship is when you start building it, it's neither good or evil. I don't care what kind of ship you make, but even if the ship you've made could hurt somebody, even if it could bring ruin to the entire world, its only parent must give it love. You mustn't deny that which you've created. The ship isn't to blame. When a man makes a ship, he makes it a part of himself." And this kind of admits to the world government that Tom is not only not sorry for building the Oro Jackson, but he also sees it as an extension of himself. Secondly, it teaches Frankie to take responsibility for the things that he makes in the future. knowing what Frankie wanted to do for having his ships be defiled by Spondum, and knowing that his own fate was already sealed, Tom hits Spondum so hard that St. Charlot started thinking that he must have got off lucky.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Tom then turns to the judge and says that he will admit to being behind the attack, but he asks a favor in return, saying that he would like to make the crime that was being excused by the creation of the Sea Train applicable to the crimes committed today, rather than for building the Oro Jackson. This would still effectively result in Tom getting the death penalty, but it would absolve Iceberg and Frankie for any wrongdoings. Tom then turns to Frankie and tells him not to torture himself because Tom had a wonderful life and his wish was fulfilled. Water 7, which was falling apart only 10 years ago, was now full of life. He had helped hundreds or thousands of people. And with that, Tom collapses, and Spondum, the big guy he is, takes the opportunity to try and arrest Frankie and Iceberg, only for the judge to call him back and saying to release them. And can we just have a quick moment to appreciate the judge here? We often see the world government painted as these evil, heartless kind of monsters, but this man was genuinely invested in bringing good to as many people as possible. He knew he had to make some kind of action, but he always chose the way that would help the most people. He chose the path that let Water 7 prosper. He chose the path that let Frankie and Iceberg go free. He is a surprisingly good dude, and it's always interesting to see, especially because he's so closely tied to Enny's lobby, which is supposed to be almost the center of the world government's corruption outside of, like, Marijua. Back to the exact opposite of that, though, Spondum goes over and kicks Tom's face, which lands him a swift bat to the face from Frankie. And while that was absolutely deserved, the Sea Train begins taking off all the same with Tom aboard. Frankie tries to get in front of it to stop it, but literally nothing he does even slows it down. And as the Sea Train plows straight through him, he begins to think that he would love to make a dream ship one day that could proudly sail to the end of the world. The people of Water 7, Iceberg included, believe that Frankie was dead, but in reality, he was barely holding on to life in the middle of the ocean. He found his way to an abandoned ship that was passing by, and decided that the first thing he would need to do is fix his useless body. And it wouldn't be until 4 years had passed, when Iceberg was working towards becoming the mayor of Water 7, that a man named Cuddy Flam would try to get an appointment with him, only to be sent away. He later meets with this man in secret. Obviously, he's a little bit surprised to see Frankie, and Frankie explains that he had to fix his body with scraps of metal that he had found and make himself a cyborg in the process just to stay alive. Iceberg realizes that the government had hounded Tom for the blueprints of Pluton and that they would eventually likely come for him next. So he tells Cuddy Flam to instead only call himself Frankie from now on and to take the blueprints and get off the island. This would be the safest way to keep them hidden. Iceberg starts to walk away after giving the blueprints over to Frankie, and as he does, he starts to talk about how he can likely never forgive Frankie for what he did, but at the same time, he wants him to know that he still trusts him enough to give him the blueprints, and that he is very happy that his friend is alive. Now, of course, Frankie did decide to go by Frankie going forward, but he refused to leave the island so that if anything ever happened, he would be able to protect Iceberg from the world government. On top of that, he would go into the Water 7 backstreets where he was attacked by Zombia and his gang. However, he very quickly laid out the entire group and told them that the backstreets now belonged to him. Later, he finds Mozu and Kiwi drunk out of their goddamn minds in the middle of the day and swaps out their booze for cola before recruiting them. And this was the beginning of the Frankie family. Water 7's mafia-like group of ship dismantlers who robbed incoming pirates. On the surface, Frankie had become the crime boss of Water 7, but in reality, he was just trying to atone for his sins. He was taking in the lost and the broken people of the town and giving them a place where they belonged. He was giving them a family. Not only that, but he was fending off looters and pirates who would cause the town harm. And by running the crime in the city, he could also keep it under his own control so that nothing too serious ever happened. And while the Franke family was definitely rowdy, for lack of a better term, they were in reality the protectors of Water 7. That said, he was still robbing people, and while most of the money would be blown on parties and cola, he was also saving up to buy wood from the Treasure Tree Atom so that he could one day build his dream ship, the same ship that he would one day build for the Straw Hats only a few years later. Now, on to the oldest member of the crew, being Brooke. The earliest thing we know about Brooke is that at some point before joining the Rumbar Pirates, he was the leader of a battle convoy for a kingdom that we know nothing about. Kind of makes me wonder if we're ever going to get more information on that island, or what's going on there now. But either way, this is where Brooke learned his unique style of swordsmanship. Eventually, Brooke would join Captain Yorkie and the Rumbar Pirates, a musical pirate ship that aimed to bring smiles to children wherever they traveled. Along the way, they had met with a young island whale that they named Laboon. He had been separated from his pod, and Brooke had the idea that they should play music for him to cheer him up. This worked, and Laboon kind of became the chopper of the group, with Brooke becoming the one that he was closest to. But then a problem came up. The Rumbar Pirates were headed to the Grand Line, and it would be too dangerous for Laboon to join them. On top of that, once Laboon crossed into the Grand Line, there would be no way for him to return to his pod ever again. So the group tried to convince the young whale to stay behind, but Laboon refused. The pirates then tried to ignore the whale to try and convince him to leave, and at first it seemed to work and he vanished, but once they entered the Grand Line, Laboon revealed himself again. The Rumbar ship needed repairs, so they spent the next 3 months fixing it at Crocus's lighthouse, all the while partying with their blubbery chum. The group then decided to leave Laboon in Crocus's care, promising that they would return after finishing making their way around the world. By then, Laboon would be grown enough and he could accompany them on their next journey. However, things didn't exactly work out like that. The Grand Line was treacherous and quickly became a difficult journey for them. Things went from bad to worse, though, when Yorkie fell fatally ill with an incurable disease. The captain made the decision to separate himself and other infected crew members from the rest of the crew in order to keep them safe. He and the other sickos would try to escape the Grand Line by going through the comm belt, which is something that definitely didn't work, but before they went out on this journey, lying on what would effectively be his deathbed, Yorkie asked two things of Brooke. Firstly, he asked him to say hi to Laboon for him when he managed to make it around the world. And secondly, he asked Brooke to play Bink's Sake for him one last time. With just over half the crew left, the remaining Rumbar pirates continued into the Grand Line on a new ship with Brooke as the captain, even gaining a bounty as they continued. His fortune was not all in the rear view, though, as the crew sailed into the Florian Triangle. They had barely survived an encounter with another crew, but even having escaped the battle, they were still in danger, as the other crew had tipped their weapons in poison and killed the Rumbar Pirate's doctor. And to make matters worse, they had also broken their rudder, so effectively they were cursed to drift aimlessly. Lost and slowly dying in the Florian Triangle, the crew had one thing bringing them hope. Brooke had eaten the Yomi Yomi Nomi, and because of that would get a second chance at life. He pulled out a tone dial and asked the crew to record Laboon's favorite song for him, so that when Brooke eventually made it back to life, he could bring it to Laboon and play it for him. Even if the Rumbar crew could not make it back to Laboon, at least their voices would. So they start playing Bink's Sake as the Rumbar pirates slowly fade one after another. This continued until all that was left was a quartet, and then a trio, a duet, and finally, just the accompaniment in a solo act. Brooke would die soon after, and eventually his soul would return to the world to seek out his body because of his devil fruit. However, the body was lost in the Florian Triangle, and by the time his soul found his body, it was just bones and an afro. Upon finding his new skeleton body, Brooke gathered the corpses of all of his friends and brought them to the coffins deep within the ship to let them rest. For the next 50 years, Brooke would be trapped in the Florian Triangle, alone on a ship with nothing but his dreams and memories of his friends to keep him company. 5 years prior to the Straw Hats arriving, Brooke's ship drifted onto Thriller Bark. He explored the island looking for materials to fix his rudder, but instead found Gecko Moria zombies. He was captured and had his shadow stolen from him before they left him back on his ship adrift in the Florian Triangle, now not even being able to go into sunlight without turning to ash. So, you know, he was having a bit of a rough time. He did eventually manage to make it back to Thriller Bark, though, and learned the secrets of using salt to defeat the zombies from Dr. Hogback. Eventually, he would come face to face with his own shadow, who was now inhabiting the body of the Swordsmaster Ryuma, and despite his best efforts, he would be defeated and forced to run away. Over the next 5 years, Brook would continue to train on his own in hopes of defeating his shadow, and when the Straw Hats finally arrived, it was his chance to do just that. Or at least to watch Zoro do so. And finally, our newest Straw Hat, Jinbei. Jinbei was raised in an orphanage which would eventually become the Fishman District along with Arlong and Fisher Tiger. He trained in Fishman Karate and proved himself a prodigy by earning a black belt by the time he was still a child. As he grew up, he would eventually become a soldier in the Neptunian Army. Jinbei back then was very weary and doubtful of Fishman and humanity coming together and saw Otohime's preaching as something that was always going to be fruitless, believing that history had been very clear about the way that humanity saw fishmen, and believing it would never change. At the same time though, while he wasn't interested in Otohime's quest, he was still a devout subject to the queen, and wouldn't allow Arlong to steal or damage the signatures that she had collected. And that kind of shows Jinbei's personality in a nutshell. Even if he disagrees with something or sees no value in it, he would never allow injustice or pointless hatred of any kind. It's a moral code that defines who he is. He and Arlong have a quick, almost Sanji and Zoro-like back and forth where they're just kind of playfully disrespecting each other, but they're interrupted when one of my personal favorite characters in the series, Fisher Tiger, returns after a long adventure. Tiger was at one point the de facto leader of the Fishman District, but now he was more of a local hero than anything. And that hero had just returned after doing something that shook the world. He opposed the Celestial Dragons and freed their slaves. If he were to remain in Fishman Island, then the entire region would become the target of humanity's wrath. Well, more so than it already was. Jinbei leaves his post in the Neptunian Army, and along with Arlong and his crew, they joined in under Fisher's Sun Pirates. To avoid discrimination between the former slaves and the former free fishmen, every member of the crew was branded with a sun that was used to cover the mark of celestial dragons on those who used to be slaves. Tiger approached Neptune and Otohime to tell them about his journey and explain what he had done and how the lives of the slaves were hell, and when asked what he had seen, Tiger responded that he had simply saw humans, and what he meant by that was that he had seen all the evil that they had to offer. And so we see this kind of schism in the parallel paths between humanity and fishmen. Otohime would work towards cohabitation and peace, while Fisher would work towards freedom and independence. As they voyaged, the Sun Pirates would regularly be attacked by marines looking to gather escaped slaves. But now with the Mark of the Sun, there was no proof of their former bondage. The Sun Pirates caused so much of a stir that they actually garnered the attention of Vice Admiral Borsellino. That said, despite everything that was happening, Fisher had a strict rule against killing humans who attacked them, much to Arlong and even Jinbei's confusion. But Tiger explained that the second that they start killing people, they lose the war and lower themselves to the level of the evil humans. They were not fighting for revenge, they were acting for freedom and liberty. Tiger understood that for every human that they kill, more hatred would arise towards the fishman race. They would only be increasing the plight of the people and innocents from their next generation who would suffer as a result. Jinbei would later meet with Tiger in the middle of the night, and Tiger would open up to him, explaining that he believed Otohime's path to be a better one, and that he believed she probably saw him no different than the bloodthirsty Arlong. But more importantly, he tells Jinbei that the one thing that he genuinely fears is the demon within himself. The next 3 years would pass with both Otohime and Fisher's efforts continuing, but things shifted when the Sun Pirates came across a young girl. Her name was Koala, and she had been freed from Marijua in Fisher's raid. But she had been stuck far from home since that had happened 3 years ago, and now the Sun Pirates were going to agree to take her home, which, believe it or not, upset Arlong quite a bit. Go figure. Koala at this point was a broken person, completely shattered from her time as a slave. She was unable to stop smiling or even to complain for fear of being tortured. Even when Arlong punches her and leaves a trail of her blood across the deck, she just tears off a piece of fabric from her pants and starts to scrub the floor, apologizing for making it dirty and promising to work hard without sleep, begging them not to hit her anymore. Jinbei approaches her and asks what she's doing while bleeding, and again she just begs and promises that she won't cry, so she hopes they won't kill her. He asks if she's so afraid of them, and she just says yes, but she wants to see her mother, so she needs to be brave, explaining that if she works hard, they might not kill her, so she'll do her best to be useful. Guys, when I say this scene breaks my heart every time I watch it, this is a criminally underrated moment in the story, and it's a shame that no one talks about it. Fisher sees Koala falling apart and orders her into his cabin, where he brands the Mark of the Sun Pirates over the Celestial Dragon Mark, explaining that the Mark of the Dragons would only bring painful memories for the rest of her life. Koala passes out from the pain, but quickly wakes up and tells them that yes, she lost consciousness, but she didn't cry, so they don't have to kill her. But before she can finish speaking, Tiger explodes, saying, "And why shouldn't you cry? We aren't the same as those slave-driving monsters." He tells her to watch as he picks up his pistol and tosses it into the ocean, saying that his crew kills no one, and then turning away and saying, "Let's get moving, we need to get this girl back home," as Koala finally breaks down crying. When they finally start heading towards Koala's home island, Arlong does stir the pot a little bit, asking Koala if her parents taught her to look down on fishmen, then going on his typical racial superiority and humans are evil speech. However, Jinbei cuts in to correct him, saying that yes, some humans are hateful, but others who look at them like Koala does aren't filled with hate, they're just filled with fear. He begins to question what they might be so afraid of, and Koala explains that they're only afraid because they don't know anything about fishmen. This putting Jinbei in a spot to wonder if Otohime's message really is the right path, and learning more about one another could actually lead to peace. Weeks later, and it's time to drop Koala off, and even Makro, who was so cold-hearted that he sold other fishmen into slavery, is crying because he's going to miss her so much. Fisher says that he'll take Koala to her village personally, and Koala promises to tell everyone about how nice fishmen are. Again, Jinbei and Arlong kind of quickly cross their moral swords as Arlong says she'll grow up to be just like the rest of humanity, and saying that Jinbei has changed if he thinks otherwise. And things are great as Koala reaches home, but this is a One Piece backstory, so things need to go to hell. As Tiger walks back to his ship, he's ambushed by Rear Admiral Strawberry and a small army of marines. They were apparently tipped off by the people of Koala's village, meaning that Tiger had gone out of his way to help this girl and even rescued her from slavery, only for her people to betray him. At the same time, the Sun Pirate's ship was also being attacked and sunk. But luckily, all the fishmen managed to escape. They steal a marine ship, but Tiger was already mortally wounded. Tiger apparently had a rare blood type, but by taking a human blood transfusion, he could be saved. However, he forbids it, screaming, saying that he doesn't want to live with their blood in his veins, the blood of those who hated fishmen, and the blood of those who captured him and made him a slave for years. We learn that Tiger managed to escape, but couldn't leave the other slaves behind, so he went back to free them too. He tells his men that he lived selfishly and caused Otohime's dream a lot of trouble, but that she is correct, and that everyone should strive for the same goal that she has. However, even with this mentality, he believed that his generation was kind of a lost cause, and it would be Koala's generation who would make the changes that they need to do to eventually see peace. And as a result, he begs his men to never speak of the betrayal and tragedy that happened on this day, so that the next generation could grow up without any stained views. Tiger says that while there are plenty of kind humans, the demon in his heart refuses to accept humanity, and he will never be able to love them. Jinbei begs him to reconsider and tells him that he's a hero to Fishman Island, to which Tiger just smiles and says that he was happy that he was able to help those worse off than he was. And with that, he closes his eyes and passes on. Arlong would go on to rampage trying to attack Koala's hometown for betraying Tiger, but Borsellino stopped him and imprisoned him in Impel Down. When interrogated, Arlong still respected Tiger's dying wish, though, as he told a lie about what had happened, saying that Tiger died because humanity refused to give him blood for a transfusion rather than him rejecting one. Jinbei, on the other hand, continued to lead the Sun Pirates with the philosophy that they would never take a life. He would also send a letter back to Ryugu Palace, explaining what had really happened, and reigniting the passion of Otohime, though the citizens would all rescind their signatures after hearing what had happened to Fisher Tiger. As time passed, Jinbei continued to gain notoriety, and his bounty raised to a quarter of a billion berries. As such, the world government offered him a position as a warlord of the sea, and he would accept with the hopes that taking this position could better the relationship between humanity and fishmen. In doing so, he also released Arlong from Impel Down, though, and rather than choosing to kill his old friend, he allowed him to roam free, which eventually allowed him to find his way to Kokoyashi Village. Jinbei would continue to act in a way that would lead towards peace between humans and fishmen, so even when Hody Jones framed a human for killing Otohime, Jinbei wanted to hide that human's body rather than cause a panic. Of course, Jinbei would years later be called to fight with the Marines in the Battle of Marineford, but refused to stand against Whitebeard, who had always acted as a figure of peace on Fishman Island. This resulted in Jinbei ending up in a cell in Impel Down with Ace, where we are first introduced to him, and where he ultimately finds Luffy as they escape. And there we go, another behemoth of a video covering these Straw Hats backstories. Let me know which one is your favorite in the comments down below. If I had to rank them from worst to best, I would probably go Usopp, Zoro, Sanji's Vinsmoke stuff, Luffy, Franky, Chopper, Robin, Sanji and Zeff, Nami, Brook, and Jinbei is a personal favorite of mine. I'm sure you all disagree, so let me know why in the comments. If you want to check out the last video I did on Anime Uproar all about the abilities of the Straw Hat crew, be sure to check that out in the description down below. And of course, if you enjoy this video and you want to see more like it in the future, be sure to leave a like and support the channel. And of course, remember to subscribe so you can stay up to date when more awesome One Piece content is released. You can also follow Anime Uproar on Twitter at Anime Uproar, or myself over on my own channel, Axel Beats. Thank you guys so much for watching, I hope you all enjoyed, and until next time, remember to stay excellent.